You are listening to Mike Seminary and Friends,
a Q1 Network production.
If you have dreams or you're wondering how to make a bigger impact in this world, you're home. Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. I'm Deb, Mike's wife. I suggested this idea as a way to keep him busy and out of my way after he retired. So far, it's working. Thanks for listening. It's time for Mike Seminary and Friends.
Welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends, the place where we strive to make a difference, a positive difference, provide you something of value. Heck, from my perspective, we just want to share good stuff. I'm your host, Mike Seminary, and I'm so grateful you've joined us. A big thanks to my friend, David Hansen, for my theme music, Continental Drift. Search for his work, Serotonin Waters and Moon Dot Soup, on iTunes and Spotify. By the way, I appreciate your comments and guest suggestions. Keep them coming at MikeSeminary.com or Mike Seminary and Friends on Facebook. And please visit us at Apple Podcasts and leave a review. Today, I'm just delighted to have as my guest a fellow Nieman fellow, former Nieman Fellow, excuse me, at Harvard University, a very accomplished and award-winning author, was an award-winning reporter, author of Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend, director of a health coverage fellowship, and is currently writing a book entitled, and I'm looking forward to reading this, The Jazzmen, How Duke Ellington, Satchmo Armstrong, and Count Basie Transformed America. My guest, I believe this morning from Boston, Massachusetts, Larry Tai. Larry, welcome to Mike Seminary and Friends. Thank you so much for taking time to join me. It's great to see you and meet you. How are you this morning?
I'm great, and I'm sitting on Cape Cod, so I'm even better than I would be if I were in Boston.
That's just wonderful. What's the weather like this morning in Cape Cod?
So it was nice enough this morning, cloudy, but nice enough that I was in the ocean at about 6 o'clock to avoid the rains that are supposed to set in for the rest of the day. So it's a good, cool day here. We're in drought, so we need the rain. And it's great to be talking to you there in the Midwest.
Well, it's similar for us, by the way. We are in the middle of a very, very dry season, as is much of the Midwest, and any moisture we get, we're thankful and blessed and desperately need it. We should let Mike Seminary and Friends listeners know the way we came to meet each other. We've never officially met. A friend of mine, longtime friend and a mutual acquaintance, Neil Goltz, had suggested I reach out to you because of the book you wrote about Satchel Paige, because it involves part of it, in some ways, a very significant part of baseball history. Involves Bismarck, North Dakota, and I just thoroughly enjoyed that book. But before we get to the book, one thing I'm always curious about when I read anyone's work, what prompted you, Larry, to focus on Satchel?
So I want to just say for a second that it's appropriate that a character like Ned Goltz, who was my college roommate, should connect us to talk about a character like Satchel Paige. And I came to Satchel, like many good things in my life, from an earlier book I wrote. And it was the book on the black men who worked on the railroads, on the sleeping cars, called the Pullman cars. And these were guys called Pullman porters. And I wrote about 15 years ago a book looking at the Pullman porters and their role in spawning the civil rights movement and in spawning today's African-American middle class. And the Pullman porters made me promise that after I got done writing about them, someday I would write a book on their favorite passenger, who was a guy named Satchel Paige. And when the Pullman porters told me to do something, I tried to do it. And so several years later, I had the joyful experience of spending nearly 2 years researching and writing this guy named Satchel, about this guy named Satchel Paige.
Well, I'm so thrilled that you did that. Kind of a side note with regards to Pullman and the railroad. Bismarck doesn't exist were it not for the railroad and were it not for the immigrants that were coming to the country back in the late 1860s, 70s, and 80s. The original name of Bismarck was Edwinton. And as the railroad, which is so important to American culture and industry and commerce, came to an end as it got to Bismarck, they were out of money. And when they finally raised enough money to resume construction, they had a labor problem. So essentially, the head of the railroad decided to let's change the name of the city from Edwinton to Bismarck in honor of Otto von Bismarck, because so many people were immigrating from Germany to this part of the country. And so, of course, the rest is history. That railroad is completed, and it wasn't always just cargo trains that came through here. There were actually passenger trains, and Pullman were a very significant part of the history of North Dakota. So thank you for letting me know that.
So I also think that Bismarck, in the days that we're going to be talking about, was a really interesting place and an incredibly unlikely place for a Black man like Satchel Paige to end up. Your listeners might know from the history of the state that the entire population of North Dakota back in the 1930s was 0.05% Black, and the capital of Bismarck had among its 12,000 residents exactly a handful of Blacks, and most of them were from a family named Spriggs. So the idea of this Black baseball phenomenon coming to Bismarck was a sense of Bismarck's openness, maybe, and a sense of Satchel Paige's being everywhere in America.
Thank you for bringing that up. And now back to your roommate, Neil Goltz. And you called him Ned. Was that his nickname or something?
I did. It was his nickname. And I think that if you had asked about Neil Goltz back in our days in college, nobody would have known who you were talking about. And it was always Ned. And he was an incredibly smart kid who graduated from Brown by the seat of his pants, because he was too busy doing all kinds of other things. But he was and is a really great guy and a true character.
He is wonderful, wonderful person. The whole family is wonderful, by the way. So what I was going to say, we grew up in Fargo, our formative years. And speaking of people of color, Blacks particularly, there were very, very few. We were fortunate to have as our school principal Brother Michael Collins, a Black man who came over from the Twin Cities. And one could make the case that when Michael Collins arrived in Fargo, North Dakota, late 67, I think it was, he had profound positive impact and influence in a virtually all-white community of Fargo because of his character, his intelligence, his heart. He was just a remarkable individual. Miss him dearly, by the way. So back to Satchel. It's interesting to me that Satchel Paige came from really a part of the country where slave trade was a large part of the economy of Mobile, Alabama at one time. And I think one of the last slave ships probably ported or docked in Mobile. And then he... he's kind of a rabble-rouser as a child, ends up in a reform school that may have been the best place for all of us for Satchel to end up, because it profoundly changed the trajectory of that young fellow's life, didn't it?
So it did, and I'm intrigued by it for two reasons. One is because Satchel said when he got out of this reform school, he said, "I gave up 7 years of freedom to learn how to pitch." And he did. He ended up in this reform school for minor offenses, but it gave him a sense of discipline, and it gave him somebody who recognized that he had a unique physical constitution and a unique athletic potential, and he really did come out of there knowing how to pitch. And it's interesting to me because probably the city in America that is most like Mobile, another Gulf Coast port city, was New Orleans. And I'm just back from New Orleans, where another guy with a similar name of Satchmo gave up his freedom. It was only 18 months of freedom to learn how to play the cornet. And that was a guy named Louis Armstrong. And I think that back then, if you were poor in black and in Jim Crow America, where segregation was the law of that land, you had a really difficult time doing anything that was going to get you ahead in the world. And it was often in a reform school setting where the schools were run by African Americans who cherished the kids who came through there and who tried to see some potential in them to do something that was going to let them get ahead in the world. And what better thing if you knew how to blow a trumpet like nobody else in the world, like Louis Armstrong, than to learn how to play in a band? And what better thing, not far away in Mobile, at exactly the same time, for Satchel Paige to come out learning how to throw a hard ball in a way that few people in the world would ever know?
I almost wanted to say, thank goodness for reform school, but in many ways, and the way you massively wrote about it, not only did it change his life in terms of baseball, he became a better student because school wasn't necessarily his thing prior to reform school. He became involved in music, loved to sing, had talents other than baseball, and one could maybe make the case, were it not for reform school, those talents and skills that he continued to share the rest of his life, we might not know about baseball, music, in terms of Satchel Paige's life, were it not for the reform school.
So all of that is definitely true, and it is sad, but it actually wasn't only black kids that this happened to. There was another smart and athletically talented young man in Baltimore, Maryland, around again the same time, who was a white kid who went to reform school and learned how to both pitch and hit a baseball, and his name was Babe Ruth.
Did you have interest in baseball prior to meeting the Pullman and keeping your promise to do a book on Satchel Paige? Were you a baseball fan of any significance?
So, Mike, you and I are about the same age, and I came up in the city or outside the city of Boston as an enormous Red Sox fan in the days when the Red Sox were a really pretty miserable ball club. And I went to as many games as I could throughout my youth. In later years, when I worked at the Boston Globe, I joined with a group of my Globe reporting and editing colleagues to share season tickets, and we're now in about our 26th year, I think, of doing that. And I grew up loving baseball. And I also grew up where my dad would take me to baseball games, and when there was a really good pitcher on the mound, he'd mention this guy that I'd never heard of named Satchel Paige as sort of the standard for what a great pitcher was. So I had in the back of my head the sense that there was some legendary character named Satchel Paige that I knew nothing about. I had the Pullman porters telling me that they loved carrying him on their sleeping cars, and I had an intense interest in the issue that I think is one of the defining issues of our country still, which is the issue of race in America. And I wanted to tell a story that would reach kids of my kids and your kids' generation about the story of Jim Crow America. But I thought if I sat down and wrote a book about Jim Crow, three people, and they'd all have to be my relatives and my friends, might read the book. But if I wrote a book about Jim Crow in America, disguised as a book about the most entertaining guy ever to pick up a baseball, that maybe we could tell the story of Jim Crow through the story of Satchel Paige, who happened to have been born the year the Jim Crow laws passed in his native Mobile, Alabama.
Before we get back to Satchel, since you shared your history of baseball, let me share it quickly mine. Before we moved to North Dakota, we were living in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And my father took me, my brother might have been along, I'm not so sure that my sister was, took me to a Milwaukee Braves baseball game. And it was at that game I first saw Hank Aaron. It was at that game I first heard really foul things said about another human being. And it was at that game how I watched my father respond to an individual close to us saying some of these things. He went over to, he put his hand on his shoulder. I could tell he was kind of squeezing him hard. It said something to him, and then came and sat back down. The guy never said another thing. Fast forward, we moved to Fargo. And I didn't stay a fan of the Braves for a couple reasons. My grandpa, who liked Ham's beer, who was the main sponsor for the Minnesota Twins and the Minnesota Vikings, and I loved my grandpa, so I became a Twins and Vikings fan. Going through the Catholic school system in Fargo, where there's Shanley High School, which was the high school of Roger Maris, one of the greatest Yankees ever, I was always getting into fights because I was a Twins fan and not a Yankees fan. But my friends thought, how can you not be a Roger Maris and Yankees fan? So there's my baseball story.
So can I tell one quick non sequitur,
please,
on what you were talking about? So I spent more time, I knew nothing about Milwaukee till the last 4 years, and I spent endless time in Milwaukee and at the great Catholic institutions of Milwaukee, including Marquette University, researching and writing about one of the most notorious characters in Milwaukee and in Wisconsin's history, a guy named Joe McCarthy. And the I loved Milwaukee's baseball heritage. I loved Milwaukee, and I went in not especially liking Joe McCarthy when I started my book. I found out some things about him that were redeeming, but a lot more that buried him even further in the grave of notoriety that I think he deserved to be buried in. And the I also found when I was at Marquette in Milwaukee, Joe McCarthy's daughter, after 60 years of saying no, gave me the key to the locked records of all of McCarthy's personal and professional papers. And so I was able to write a biography about McCarthy that hopefully said things that people didn't know before about him. And it happened to come out at a moment when the story of McCarthy and the story of demagogues in our world seemed especially relevant given what was going on in Washington. And I won't get into more politics unless you want to, but the there are good guy characters that you write about, like Satchel Paige, and there are bad guy characters you write about, like Joe McCarthy. And during the time you're researching, you are so into their stories that you feel like you're living and breathing these people. And it was a whole lot more fun doing that with Satchel than with Joe.
Yeah. And the name of that book, by the way, it's, and again, it's I believe it's an award-winning book, Demagogue, The Life and Long Shadow of Senator Joe McCarthy. And I would encourage listeners to get that book and read it. Before we talk about Satchel, Jim Crow, in the summer of 1970, along with Ned, or Neil, brother, Thomas, we joined an organization for the summer called Teen Corps. It was based out of the Twin Cities. It was essentially like Peace Corps, but it was for teenagers in working on domestic projects in the United States. The group we were associated with happened to go to Appalachia, and there were various camps established throughout Tennessee and Kentucky. Again, this is the summer of 1970. And Jim Crow was still very alive and present and visible in the summer of 1970. And you came from Fargo, North Dakota, and your experience, you're now finishing your second year of high school, and the leader of your school is a black man. It was just unconscionable for us to see some of the things that we experience during the summer of volunteerism in Tennessee and Kentucky. Let's fast forward to Bismarck, because I agree with you. I think Bismarck, because the culture was, you know, different than a lot of parts of the country, in some ways history was made in Bismarck, North Dakota, when a car dealer, entrepreneur, hotel owner by the name of Neil Churchill, because of his competitive nature, he needed to beat this town, this team out of Jamestown, North Dakota. He ended up bringing Satchel Paige to Bismarck, North Dakota. Share with the listeners what you learned about that that event that took place in 1933.
So he brought in Satchel, and what he wanted was a winning team. What Satchel wanted was an extra paycheck, and it was the perfect confluence of the interests. And Satchel came in, and every time he picked up the baseball, he performed a little bit of magic. He helped Churchill beat the team in Jamestown and go on to be one of the great pickup teams of all times. But he also, I think, by bringing in this black star, he did something much more. He said to Bismarck, you may not have a whole lot of African Americans living in your presence, but here is a true artist. And he is, if I were bringing in somebody to introduce white America to a great and entertaining black American, and to show that the races were equal in every way, there was no better person to make that case through than Satchel Paige. And it was made in the way of not telling people, but showing them. Every time Satchel would go out and pitch, he delivered for Churchill in a way that was a dream and made for a brilliant summer in that summer of 1933.
And he was playing also with white players, correct?
He was playing with white players. So what Satchel did, the typical baseball player in the 1930s who was playing in the major leagues, the same as the typical baseball player today, makes enough money and exhausts themselves enough by playing in their conventional big league season that begins with spring training and ends, if they're lucky, in October, for most ball players, in September. And that's the extent of their season. For Satchel Paige, he was playing in the black equivalent to the white major leagues, which were the Negro Leagues. But in addition to pitching for the team that he was signed for in the Negro Leagues, he would pitch a baseball just about every day or night of the year, partly because he needed to earn enough money, and partly because he was in such demand, including in Bismarck, North Dakota, that it was extraordinary. And he would play with whatever team he was put in with, and those were often the first integrated teams. Bismarck, North Dakota was pioneering during that Jim Crow era in fielding a team that had lots of white ball players and had this star black pitcher named Satchel Paige. And he did more in setting the table for the integration of baseball and ultimately the integration of America than is generally realized. People think that that baseball was integrated when a guy named Branch Rickey decided to sign a great black baseball player named Jackie Robinson, and that's how baseball was integrated. The story, the true story is that if Jackie Robin was the father of integrated baseball, Satchel Paige was the grandfather. He was out there setting this table by showing that blacks and whites could play together, by showing major league owners through a season like what he did in Bismarck, just how great a black ball player could be in redeeming a mediocre white ball club. And the reason Branch Rickey signed Jackie Robinson was not because he was against segregation in America. It was because he knew he could make a big buck by bringing in great black baseball stars. And that's why he did it. And it was Satchel who showed him more than any of the black ball players of that era just how good black ball players could be.
Joe DiMaggio's, I may mess up the quote, Joe DiMaggio, one of the greatest baseball players of all time, said, Satchel is the best and fastest pitcher I've ever faced. And I bring that up after what you just said because in comparison to professional white baseball at that time, where the season was confined to those time frames that you just addressed, Satchel was pitching, if he could, 12 months a year because he wanted and needed the money. It also helped him with his ego. But there were weekends where he'd pitch two or three games because of the way baseball was played at that time. He was a remarkable physical specimen to be able to do that, particularly considering how hard and fast he threw the baseball. That's a safe statement to make?
It's an incredibly safe statement to make. And he would not just pitch the ball game, but he would show up early to entertain fans who were putting out hard $1, and especially black fans who couldn't afford some of these prices. He'd show up early and he'd put on a show. And the show would be one of his teammates would take a lit cigarette and put it in their mouth, and Satchel would throw a blistering fastball and knock the cigarette out of their mouth. And that suggested not just how accurate he was, but how much faith his teammates had in him. There weren't many people that anybody would, you know, put a cigarette in their mouth and have a fastball thrown near their head. Satchel threw so hard that the old catcher's mitt from those days, and if your listeners have ever seen those sort of flat catcher's mitts, they weren't enough to cushion the ball that was being thrown for these catchers. So they'd often put a beefsteak in their mitt to sort of give them an extra layer of cushioning so that their hand wouldn't feel like it had been ripped off at the end of a game catching Satchel Paige. He was a phenomenon and one of the most egotistical and brilliant pitchers ever to pick up a baseball was a guy who pitched for the Cleveland Indians way back when, a guy named Bob Feller. And I interviewed Feller for the Satchel book and asked him how fast was Satchel pitching. Now, Bob Feller had gone out with his team of white all-stars after the season and played against Satchel Paige's black all-stars, and they flew all across America. And Feller, who never had a very good word to say about any other ball player but Bob Feller, Feller told me that Satchel pitched so fast that while they didn't have radar guns in those days, he guesstimated that Satchel was throwing 105 miles an hour. Now, you know, and your listeners know, that any pitcher who pitches 100 miles an hour has a blistering pitch. And the idea that Bob Feller was saying that Satchel was doing it at the level of 105 gives just a sense of how he was defying physics and storytelling in terms of what he was able to do. And very recently, Major League Baseball, to try to atone for its system of racism for all those years, said in the last couple months, we are going to try to incorporate into our record books the records of these great black ball players, not just when they pitched in the major leagues, but in their Negro leagues days. And I don't think Major League Baseball realized quite what it was doing, because Satchel Paige, I want to just give you a couple numbers in terms of the records that Satchel said that he had accumulated. And my record keeping suggests that in some cases he was actually undercounting. But he said that he pitched 2,500 games and won 2,000. He said that he played for 250 teams and pitched 250 shutouts. He said that in one game, he struck out 22 batters. And they were not just any batters, they were major league barnstormers. He said that he pitched 50 no-hitters and he won 21 straight games. And the last record was the one that you mentioned. He said that in a single day, he once recorded 3 wins. Now, these are things that defy the imagination, and they certainly defy the white record books. And if Major League Baseball follows through on its commitment, just about every record that a pitcher has ever set in baseball, Satchel Paige broke. One last record that he broke, and this is a record that will never, ever be matched. He pitched his last game, 3 innings for the Kansas City A's. He pitched that at 59 years old. Now, that is, to me, a record that we'll never, ever get even close to.
That's just absolutely amazing, because he, if I recall from your book, he had actually retired about 12 years earlier, somewhere around 48 or 49, and then to come back and pitch at age 59, well, just 59 in general, but 59 after being retired is absolutely stunning. I'm trying to go ahead, I'm sorry.
You're exactly right. He had been long retired, and he came back, and it was a stunt. Charlie Finley, the owner of the Kansas City A's back then, hadn't filled up his stadium the entire season, and he figured in September that he could fill it up for one night if he hired the ancient Satchel Paige to come and pitch 3 innings. So he set him up near the bullpen with a nurse in a white uniform and a rocking chair. And it was a stunt. And he managed to fill up the stadium, but Satchel never let anybody get the last word. He proceeded to pitch 3 shutout innings against the Boston Red Sox, and the only player to get a hit against him was one of my favorite players, a guy named Carl Yastrzemski. And Carl Yastrzemski, after the game, went and gave Satchel a bear hug. And that was not because Yastrzemski was a warm and fuzzy guy. He wasn't. But it was because a full generation before that, Yastrzemski's dad, who was a potato farmer on Long Island, had batted in a pickup baseball game against Satchel Paige. He was the only guy in the history of baseball that could have fathers and sons and even grandsons all bat against him, and he managed generally to strike out all of them.
That's amazing. Did you say 2,500 games?
That's what Satchel said, was 2,500 games, and it just seemed inconceivable to me. And then I started adding up how many years he pitched. And if you pitch for 40 years, pitching an average of, let's say, 300 games a year, you get to those kinds of numbers. And every record that I try to diagnose, assuming that Satchel was exaggerating, I came up with the fact that they were all credible. And it wasn't as if, you know, sometimes he was pitching against pickup teams in places like Jamestown, North Dakota, but more often he was pitching against the best of the black baseball players or against white Major League All-Stars, where people like Joe DiMaggio and Bob Feller were seeing just how good he was.
I was trying to do quick math in my head, so I cheated and I brought up my iPhone. Cy Young is the person that holds the record for the most innings pitched, and that's 7,356. If that number is correct, 2,500, I can only imagine how many innings pitched Satchel actually has to his credit. It, far more than 7,356, I would
say. Exactly. If he was only pitching three innings for all of those games, he would match Cy Young's record. And he pitched very often nine innings. And sometimes he did it so convincingly, and he was such a showman, that he would actually tell his outfielders and even his infielders to sit down for the last inning. And he was so convinced he could strike out the team that he managed to do it essentially as a one-man team. And these were things that, again, he did because he was an entertainer. He was so much like Louis Armstrong. And Louis Armstrong is known for two things in his life. He's known for being the greatest jazz artist who pioneered trumpet playing and singing in ways that we had never imagined could be done. But he was also an amazing performer. And he played to enormous audiences into his 60s. And Satchel Paige was the same way. He was partly about being an artist, and he was partly about being an entertainer. And that is what African Americans of that era had to do to make a name and to make money.
The other thing that Satchel did, and thanks for reminding me, Larry, his pitching delivery may be the most unique of anyone that's ever played baseball as a pitcher. He would take his leg and he would put it up over his head, essentially, lean back with his long arm, and then sometimes hold, like he's posing, and then throw these blistering, hot, fast pitches that were confusing for a batter because when's he going to throw the ball? And then all of a sudden it's in the catcher's mitt. He had that just really odd, long pose-type delivery that would, I don't know that anybody else has ever done it, to my knowledge.
So he had that extraordinary pose, and he had extraordinary long limbs that it looked like when he swung his arm forward to release the ball, it seemed like his hand was in the batter's face. And it was amazing. And if anybody is interested in sort of seeing what Satchel Paige looked like, you ought to check out the statue of him in front of the Baseball Hall of Fame. This is a guy who was the first of the Negro League era ball players to be admitted to Cooperstown Baseball's Hall of Fame. They did it in a classically ham-handed way of saying, we're going to put you, Satchel, and all those Negro League ball players who qualified into the Hall of Fame, but into a special segregated corridor. And guys like Ted Williams said, what are you talking about? You can't do that. And so they put him where he belonged in the center of the Hall of Fame, and they ultimately put a statue of him out front that when you go to the Hall of Fame, you will be greeted by this wonderful, extraordinary, long-limbed pitcher in full pitching form in a statue that hopefully will last forever, like Satchel's records will.
Gus Greenlee was one of his managers. I'm not sure what the correct term is, owned a team that Satchel played for. He was somewhat of an unsavory fellow. Is that a fair statement to make?
So it's totally fair to make. He was the classic kind of nightclub and bar owner in that era, an era that survived through Prohibition with bootleg whiskey, that survived generally by having mob connections. And in Greenlee's case, he was, on the one hand, one of the greatest owners ever of a Negro League team, and Pittsburgh was the center of the action in the Negro Leagues in those days, two of the greatest teams ever, and Greenlee was the perfect kind of owner to have a character like Satchel Paige.
He was, if I recall the book, that he was the guy that Satchel was pitching for when all of a sudden they're wondering where he is and he ends up in Bismarck.
And so Exactly right. That having signed a contract with Greenlee didn't mean that Satchel was going to stay there if Churchill was offering more money to come out to Bismarck. And Satchel would sign a contract with a team like the Pittsburgh Crawfords and the great crosstown team, the Homestead Grays. But he was enough of a character, enough of a free agent before anybody ever knew the term free agent associated with baseball. And he was good enough that he could get away with it. He'd sign contracts, he'd break contracts, and people would re-sign him because there was nobody who could earn them more money night after night than Satchel.
And the reason I brought up Gus, Larry, and for Mike Semin and Friends listeners is that I don't know that you said it in the book. And again, the book is Satchel, The Life and Times of an American Legend. I would encourage you to go online and buy it. It's a wonderful book. I don't know that you necessarily said it, but you painted the picture that Gus Greenlee was actually kind of a mobster.
Absolutely a mobster, yeah. In the best sense of the word and the worst.
Breaking a contract with him, maybe if anybody else other than Satchel Paige, probably wouldn't turn out good for you is what I was thinking as I read about him.
So breaking a contract with Gus Greenlee, if you weren't Satchel Paige, could have meant he'd come back and break something of yours. And I think that nobody would have ever dared to do that. But one of the many things Satchel pioneered by going from sort of team to team and bidding for whoever would pay the most for his services, he was in a way telegraphing the era that would come a whole lot later in the era of free agency. And the Satchel was a pioneer in many things and in recognizing that ball players ought to have a certain control over their financial future. He set the pace and set the amounts that people ought to be paid. And he ended up, when you added up all of his money, he was making the kinds of money that Babe Ruth and later Joe DiMaggio and Ted Williams were making. He was working a whole lot harder, but he was making that kind of big dollar back then.
Before we leave Gus Greenlee, one of the things that he did was very positive. He essentially established a bank that for the black population. And were it not for him doing that, it would have been very difficult for a lot of folks to be able to establish credit, borrow money, and make a life for themselves.
So that is absolutely true. And like most wealthy blacks of that era, you had to do some things that were sort of under world and underhanded to have the resources to do other things that were really beneficent. And this was a guy who took from the world with his speakeasies and nightclubs and gave back through his giving Black America and America generally one of the greatest Negro League ball clubs ever, and a black bank, and a lot of giveaways around holidays and other things, of turkeys and all kinds of stuff.
I don't know if Satchel, again, I'm visiting with Larry Tai, author of the book that we're talking about Satchel. I don't know if he invented it, but he was pretty good at trash talking. As I read your book, there were probably as many people on the team that liked him that didn't like him.
So absolutely. If you were on the other team, he would, and again, uncharacteristic of what we think of as what baseball players would do, he would call you every name in the world. He would try to entice you to come off the base and maybe go after him. He believed that he knew how to talk with eloquence and with street talk. He knew just what was going to get under the skin of the opposing ball players. He knew that trash talking was entertaining for fans, so he did it. And he would do anything that it took. I mean, who ever heard of telling your fielders to actually sit down and having them do it and do it with the confidence that they were still going to win the ball game? And to Satchel, it was all about one thing more than anything, which was having fun, which is, I want to make an editorial comment here, which is, I think if Branch Rickey had had a sense of whimsy, he would have hired as his barrier-breaking ball player Satchel Paige and not Jackie Robinson. Jackie Robinson was younger, but the world only knew about Jackie Robinson because he started that critical season that Branch Rickey discovered him as the second-string second baseman on Satchel Paige's Kansas City Monarchs. And Rickey was actually, some people were encouraging him to sign up Satchel Paige, but he thought as a guy entering his 40s that Satchel was too old. He thought as a trash-talking ball player that Satchel was too unwieldy. And what he didn't realize was that white fans already knew about Satchel Paige, and they would have come out in even bigger numbers to watch him than they did Jackie. And Jackie Robinson, after that first barrier-breaking season in the majors, developed ulcers. Satchel Paige would have had a blast being out there. He would have taken whatever abuse was thrown his name, because he had been taking that for 25 years, and he would have been great the way he was the next year when the Cleveland Indians hired him and he helped lead them to the World Series, and he would have been fun. And that just wasn't the kind of risk that Branch Rickey wanted to take. But had Bill Veeck been the one to break the barrier, Bill Veeck, the owner of the Cleveland Indians, he would have hired Satchel and not Jackie.
Mm-hmm. And Jackie was a veteran, correct, as well?
Jackie was a veteran. Jackie was a college boy. He was a guy who was going to take Branch Rickey's orders and not yell back at him or yell back at the racist who was screaming at him from the stands. But had you taken a vote of all the Negro League ballplayers of that era, they wouldn't have even known about Jackie to vote for him. They would have, with a consensus vote, have said Satchel was the guy they wanted representing them as the first guy. And one old Negro League ball player put it better than anybody else. He said, Jackie Robinson opened the door to the new racial reality in baseball, but it was Satchel Paige who turned the key.
Oh, that's a great comment. I think also in the book, I think it was actually one of the reporters wrote, and I'm paraphrasing, that Satchel freed more Negroes from, I'm messing it up, freed more Negroes than Lincoln. Or I'm just butchering that. Do you recall the quote?
So the spirit of what you're saying is that Satchel Paige really transformed in a way that he never has gotten credit for, transformed not just the racial situation in baseball, but in America. Your listeners, again, will remember that baseball integrated long before the schools and everything else in the country. And at the time that Satchel Paige was coming up, we were talking about Jim Crow earlier. And for younger listeners, Jim Crow is the shorthand name given to that whole network of racial segregation, where there were separate schools for blacks and whites. There were separate places where they could sit on buses or on trains. And there were even separate and racially segregated water fountains. And Satchel grew up in that era, and he helped end that era.
One of my favorite athletes of all time, I first learned of him in 1960 because my father and grandfather loved boxing. At that time, he was known as Cassius Clay, who would become Muhammad Ali. I see so many similarities between Satchel and Muhammad Ali. At times flamboyant, talented like nobody else, had the gift of gab where they knew just how far to go with what they wanted to say to throw you off your game, and then they knew they had you. And I loved Muhammad Ali during his entire life. I just thought he was one of the most unique and special people ever. It would have been fun to be able to watch Satchel Paige perform as well.
So can I just say your comparison is totally on point in terms of the kinds of characters that Satchel and Muhammad Ali were. The biggest difference between them was Muhammad Ali, from the beginning, got to box in the equivalent of the major leagues. He was there fighting for world championships, and he spent his career in the big leagues. The sad thing about Satchel Paige is that he spent his heyday, his 20s and his 30s, pitching in this shadow world of the Negro Leagues. And so America was denied the televised and the high-profile look at what he was like in his heyday. And we only got to see him when he was what for most people would have been at retirement age. And it just is so sad. It would be like if Ali had only been able to really compete for the championships when he was an old man. And in his later days, it was sort of sad watching Ali because he had lost that sort of extra step and the ability to bounce around the ring and the youthfulness. And Satchel ended up in places showing his youthful talents in places like Bismarck, North Dakota, which were outlying areas, and lucky for Bismarck and sad for everywhere else that they didn't get to see him.
Larry, when will the Jazzmen be available? And then what prompted you to write it? Then I'm going to come back to Satchel again.
Great. So the Jazzmen will be out. I'm just digging into the research now. I was recently, as I mentioned, in New Orleans. I'm going to head to Kansas City and Chicago and New York and New Jersey and London and Paris and all the places where jazz really thrived the most. And I hope the book will be out, and my publisher is counting on the book being out in about 2 years. And okay, it came about the same way, in a way that Satchel did. It was the Pullman Porters who said, you got to write about Satchel Paige. And they said, you got to write about three of our favorite musical, the idols. And they were Ellington, Armstrong, and Basie. And I think that their story is very much like the story of Satchel. Satchel helped convince a generation of Americans that blacks deserved to be playing baseball in the major leagues. Guys like Louis Armstrong were taking their music into the homes of white Americans who wouldn't have let a black man walk through their door. And I've heard from more people who came from a family history of Southern racial biases or Northern racial biases that their racist uncles or grandparents wooed their wives with the music of Louis Armstrong. So he showed, as did Duke Ellington and Count Basie, just how great a black artist could be, and that helped convince the country that blacks deserved equal opportunities to great white artists and whites generally.
If I'm not mistaken, Duke Ellington and Count Basie have a history attached to Fargo. There used to be a ballroom. I don't remember the name. I could email it to you, but I'm almost positive they both had performed in Fargo, and I'm going to say sometime in the 40s, somewhere in that area.
So that is totally consistent with what they were doing during that time. Count Basie especially was traveling across the Midwest and the Southwest before he made it to New York and the big times. He was night after night playing in places like Bismarck, and that was exactly what he was doing, and that was what Duke Ellington did, and that was what Louis Armstrong did into his 60s. For all that he was a great TV star, a great radio performer, and in the movies, he was also doing, for most of his life, one-night stands all across America, and that was the brilliance of these guys. They were taking their artistry to outlying parts of America and convincing the country that they were worthy of buying their records, watching their movies, and seeing them as geniuses that they were.
Larry, let me ask you this question, and I'll do it this way. If you had a magic wand you could wave over the heads of every one of my listeners, and anybody for that matter, that should be reading about the Jasmine, that should be reading about Satchel Paige, that should be reading about the Pullman Porters and their significant contribution to our country, tell them why they should read those books and what you want them to get from your work.
Great. So there are two different answers to the two questions you pose. They should read the books because there are no more entertaining and magical figures to read about than Satchel Paige, Satchmo Armstrong, and Ellington and Basie. Their stories are stories of magic, guys who came from nowhere and dazzled America. And if you didn't know about them, you ought to, or you ought to ask your parents or grandparents who these four people were. That is why people should read about them. What I hope the people get from them is the broader story we were talking about before, that I said about Satchel Paige when I was trying to sell this book to a publisher, I said, this is a biography of two American icons, Satchel Paige and Jim Crow. The story of Satchel is the story of race in America, and that story has never been more timely than today, when race is back where it belongs as a front and center issue for all of America to deal with. And to deal with the issue of race in America today, you have to know the history of Jim Crow and the history of race in America from the Civil War through the 1960s. And the most painless way to read that is to read it disguised as a story of people you want to be reading about anyway.
What are the best ways, Larry, for people to follow you, or not necessarily, just to follow you? Do you have a website that you'd like people to know?
I have a website. My website is very simple. It is my name, LARRYTYE.com. And you can follow, if anybody is ever tempted to read one of my books, I implore them to buy it at their local independent bookstore, not to just go on Amazon and click there. And they're available in just about every bookstore. They're orderable through your local bookstore, and support your Fargo bookstore or your Bismarck bookstore and whatever they are.
Thank you. I appreciate that very much. Local is always best. Last question. After the publishing of Satchel, did you have an opportunity to circle back to any of the folks that you interviewed for the Pullman Porters? Did you have a chance to circle back and visit with them?
So the good news is I kept in touch with the Porters through this whole process. The bad news is that when I started my book on the Pullman Porters, there were 50 of them who I interviewed, and they were about the only ones still alive. By the time the book on Satchel Paige came out, there were very few of them who were still around. And today, I think I can say clearly that there are no Pullman Porters still living in America, and that's a huge loss to me and to the country.
It certainly is. I'm looking forward to reading more of your work, and I'm so appreciative of Ned, better known as Neil Goltz to me, encouraged me to reach out to you. I love your work. I enjoyed our conversation today, and I'm looking forward to reading more of your work. Thank you so much, Larry, for joining me on Mike Seminary and Friends.
Great. So I want to just end with one last thing, which is telling the people of North Dakota what a gem they have in Mike Seminary and his show. And so you're already, obviously, if you're listening, you're loyal fans of his. But I just want to say I do a lot of interviews, and very few meet the standard that Mike did today. Thank you.
Oh, Larry, thank you so very much. I appreciate that.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us today. You are profoundly appreciated. Where would I be without the team at Q1 Network? Anna Deavere, Ashley Harris, Bo Hastings, and Marlo Anderson. And my wife, Deb. Deb really orchestrates all of this for me. I have an incredible wife, partner, and friend. Thanks again for listening to Mike Seminary and Friends. Until we chat again, love y'all.